Welcome to Sector Head Spotlight. I'm your host, Robert McGrory. We're about to review the background and process of a hedge-eye sector head, as well as discuss some specific key themes pertinent to today's market conditions. If you'd like to learn more about their research,
go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe.
Now, let's dive into this episode.
Good morning, Hedgeye Nation. This is actually my wife's birthday. I should probably know this date, Ami. It's March 9th. So happy birthday to my dear wife. And oddly enough, my best man at my wedding is also born today. So happy 40th, Lynn. But that is not why we're here. We are here for Sector Head Spotlight. I get the pleasure of having Ami Joseph, our Sector Head of Technology, join me today. So thank you, Ami, for taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know it's kind of quarter end and tail end of earnings season, so I really appreciate your time, bud.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So one of my favorite things, so Ami, and for those at home, you know, the typical sort of format here that we go through, and we're on I think episode 8 or 9 of these from Sector Head from speaking with various Sector Heads so far. I got a few more left. But the typical format, Ami, is, you know, we go through a bit of your background. Again, we don't need to get too far into the weeds and you know, all the way from at the beginning. But, you know, whatever you think may be prevalent and certainly more so geared kind of like the hedgeye portion of the hedgeye story, sort of how you end up landing here. And then we'd love to kind of go dive into your process and some of the things that that influence your the way that you curate your coverage list, and then lastly, some other, you know, key concepts or key kind of takeaways that you'd like to impart on to Hedgeye Nation for 2023. And before you get into your background, one of my favorite aspects of certainly something that you I'd say is relatively unique to you. I know. Freebird also uses a lot of Bob Rich cartoons, but I love them. You know, all the cartoons that you've enjoyed and sort of leverage Bob for, you know, general. I don't know if you can throw on slide 5 there, but yeah, before we get into your background, Ami, if did you come up with sort of these concepts? Like, how does this work? Because, like, I think you have a quite the Rolodex of cartoons in your for the technology sector, and some of them are awesome.
Thank you very much. Actually, it was one of the selling points on me joining Hedgeye was having access to Bob. Not even kidding.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the cartoon generation, comic book generation, collecting comic books, and I always believed in the medium. So the fact that I could take a complicated thesis and exhibit it in a single cartoon, that would mean, one, I'd done my work, that I knew the company or I knew the thesis really, really well. And I think some of our best calls ever are when we're able to draw that out into a cartoon. And Bob, obviously, he does the hard work of actually making the cartoon a reality. So I think it's a very important part of what we do here, and also very unique.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So going back to kind of, you know, how you joined Hedgeye, do you mind just running through that bit of your history as well?
Sure. It was about 7 years ago. I had left Putnam to build my own thing, which started out, had tried to build one thing, and then it became another when a large family office, instead of investing in what I had wanted them to invest in, said, why don't you instead create longs and shorts for us in our book, and we'll pay you for that. And so then light bulb went off, and I was like, okay, that's kind of interesting, and started scaling a number of different customers to do that for them. And I was basically running that business when I met Keith. A client of mine was also a client of Keith's and introduced us and said, you guys would be a natural fit together. And Keith said, come here and we'll scale you up. And the rest is history. That's kind of like how that was born. Do you want to go further back in the
book? Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, keep on rolling. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, I started as a banker out of college, and then I worked in the telecom equipment industry for a startup that was backed by Sequoia. And then I came, that all ended in the 2000 and 2001 period bubble. And then I came back to Wall Street to do equity research at Thomas Weisel Partners and Semiconductors. was there for a few years. Then I went to Fidelity for a few years doing semis and hard domestic US semis and hardware. I moved over to Putnam to do all international tech, like everything non-US, which was, I loved that job. That was everything from, you know, I'd be on the phone with the, you know, data center companies in Europe at 5 a.m. my time, and I'd finish the day at 11 p.m. with Korean equipment companies who were going to try to take on Lam Research and Applied Materials and everything in between, and every business model and every size of company. And it was just so invigorating. I loved it.
That's awesome. Was that both, out of curiosity, was that both on the public and private side?
No, only public.
Remember,
crossover period really for public equity investors really only started in that 2011, 12, 13, 14 period. Sure. By 2015, you had, Bill, I forget his name off the top of my head, Bill Gurley, complaining about it and excoriating public investors at a there was Morgan Stanley conference, technology conference in San Francisco, or Goldman Sachs. Same, it was those two conferences used to happen a month apart and at the exact same physical location. So it's like, I can't remember which is which, but yeah. I remember Bill Gurley like excoriating, and it was still early in the trend. It was like 2015 or maybe as late as 2016, maybe. I think it was 15. And he was excoriating public equity investors for coming into his world and messing with the apple cart and overvaluing companies, throwing too much money at companies and overvaluing them and so on and so forth. And that was interesting. But that trend happened really kind of like while I was building my own thing. And gotcha. I had at times customers who would ask me to go check out privates, but I like pretty much straight up refused. Cause I was just like,
sure.
I'm like, I can't, with the number of customers I had and how I was doing things, and all that bespoke, development of longs and shorts that were unique for each customer and that would fit into their portfolios. I did not have time to spend 6 weeks on a private company where the information was going to be hard to run down and all that kind of stuff. I did not need that.
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager in chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40 plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything.
Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe.
And tune in live to the call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And then, so it's a good segue in my opinion, kind of your process. So General, if you don't mind pulling up slide four there, where you combine kind of like the product process, you know, snapshot there. I think it's a great, it's a great kind of diagram. So I don't know if you typically start with one versus the other, whether it's thematic or where, but why don't I kind of leave it to you to sort of walk folks through this process? Cause I think it's a great representation of what you do.
Yeah, I'll dance in and out of product and process. I'll start with product just for a sec for the marketing
element, sure.
Which is, you know, for all those who are on this who don't know, we have a totally free podcast that comes out every 2 weeks on Saturday mornings at 9:01 a.m. And that is available on Spotify and on Apple Podcast. And we also put that out on Twitter. Free and available podcast for discussing like really anything that's out there. Sometimes we host people as well. Sometimes it's Hedgeye people, but really just kind of like any kind of curiosity along the way that we just kind of like want to like discuss and debate. And that's with Andrew Friedman and Felix Wang as well. So that's kind of one stage of the process and product. We do a quarterly thematic look, which is kind of at this point become what I call the space in between my work and Keith's work. So if you look at all of our individual work on individual single stocks, that was the first, 5 years, at least five and a half years was just doing that bottom up single stock work. And then a client said to us, well, what if you like roll that all up and aggregate it across the sector, what would it look like? And so it became this sort of like the space in between Keith's macro work and basically what I'd call macro tech. We've got a few slides of that here in the deck, Robert, if you want to go visit those at some point. But that actually has been really, as you can imagine, really critical for the last like six quarters, seven quarters. We do one themes deck a quarter just to show everybody and us really kind of like where we are with like, you know, the roller coaster that it's been. How estimates look and how multiples look and how data is trending. And so like, you know, kind of roll all that up and also look for outstanding stocks that maybe it's time to go look at or maybe just explain recent moves as well from some of the data. So it's a really good part of the process. But the main thing we try to do is just go after individual single stocks, which has been tricky for the last like year, I would say, just because of the volatility. Like you start going after something as a long and it's up 30% before you have a chance to get your workout or vice versa on the short side. So it's been very volatile, but I'm very blessed and happy to say that we're back in idea zone right now and creating new ideas. And I think we're going to have a lot of new ideas this year. So
that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I'll leave it to you. I mean, do you want to kind of just kind of press on a little bit on the thematic side and then circle up and, or how would you prefer to do it?
Actually, now that I realized that all I did was there was product and not process.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. I guess we go into the process then.
Well, in advance of this, of today, I had some thoughts that I wanted to maybe share and like some things that have shaped my investing career. And I'll give an example. I think, you know, technology is one of those areas that is disruptive and deflationary, and computing is a way of adding automation into the world and accelerates everything that we do and adds new capacities and capabilities. So I think there's a lot of amazing power that everybody listening can probably also talk about the changes in their life of technology and what you can do today versus things you couldn't do before and whatnot. So I think there's, you know, we can all get excited about that. And along the way, I think there are things that really have captured my focus and attention. Like, for example, for a long time, I sort of saw the smartphone trend coming. Let's just use that one as an example. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so today, for example, if somebody is thinking about a major new trend, you know, and they see it coming, they can feel it, they could see it in everything that they do. But if you look back at the stocks, there were three available stocks to invest in at the time in the smartphone industry. And during that sort of like really like that Aufklärung stage, that enlightened, that growth from nothing to something stage, call it like the aughts, like that.
Yep.
I want to say 2003 to 2007, but it's probably a little wider than that. But let's just go with that period. There was Palm. There was BlackBerry, and there was one more that I don't even remember. A Taiwanese company, HPC. I forget. Anyway, I'm forgetting. Sorry. 2498 is the symbol. If you had just gone long the smartphone industry and bought Palm, you would have massively underperformed the trend. You would have been disappointed with yourself. You would have, I think you might have underperformed the S&P in that time frame too, because there was a big energy rally. So it wouldn't, all of your great insight on the next big thing would have been wasted. Yeah. And so really getting to know these companies at a bottom up level and get to know something beyond just get to know them. It's also, it's not like get to know like their earnings or how much cash flow they have, but something about the pace of innovation, the pace of iteration of product and market and pricing and those kinds of things, like which company is really kind of like hitting constantly against all of that. And you know, you're going to have to buy these things. You're probably not going to be buying things at the trough, and you're going to be buying them expensive in that sense also. So you have to also do some other analytical work to give you comfort, because you don't want to be the last idiot in. You don't want to be the guy who's buying when everybody knows and everybody's already bought a smartphone. So you've got to do your own work about TAM, addressable opportunities. Can't go to Gartner, can't go to IDC. Gartner, IDC, great companies on a lot of levels, but they're paid to come up with TAM numbers for companies. Like, you know, and obviously the bigger the TAM number, the better, the more money, the more popular their service is going to be. So you can't go for those.
Exactly.
You have to make your own. And that's hard work. You've got to go and sit and think and do work about these things. And you've got to also stay attention to pace. There are different times where the TAM grows faster and slower. And that's just math. There's math alongside the S curve of adoption. So all those things are like good examples of rules of thumb that I learned the good and the bad way. And by the way, not falling in love. Like, there was a time to sell BlackBerry. There was a time to leave BlackBerry.
It's funny you bring those up, because I remember I was at Canaccord up in, now Canaccord Genuity up in Toronto, and BlackBerry was obviously a darling being a Canadian company. And when the iPhone, sort of when they made that first announcement, I remember our tech analysts really being kind of being cautious and conscientious, but also somewhat more optimistic than many would have thought that he would be about the iPhone and the opportunity of sort of the difference in terms of having like a touch screen versus the keyboard. And many investors, I remember sitting down with a number of them in terms of it's almost like they had recency bias, right? Or like, well, I can't imagine like ever giving up my QWERTY keyboard on my BlackBerry, because it was at that point it would have been, at least 5 years probably, where it was like, tethered to their hip and allowed them to be more mobile and et cetera, et cetera. So it was just a very fascinating, like looking back in time, because I think that iPhone came out in 07, if memory serves, might've been 08, but I think it was 07. But it was just like, when you look back in time, what was that? That's about 15 years later, and the iPhone being pretty much the absolute dominant player in that space. And the TAM market probably, even greater than what one would have imagined when Jobs kind of initially came up with this concept of kind of trying to disrupt the cell phone industry. Because at that point, again, I mean, the Taiwanese company as well, but I mean, your dominant player, especially overseas, was Nokia, really, for the rest of the globe, right? Like, it was, BlackBerry was certainly, and Palm were certainly the business oriented, cell phones, but yeah, it's from a global standpoint, Nokia. And again, like, if you invested in Nokia, and you and I, before I joined Hedge, I know you and I kind of had a bit of a conversation on Twitter about Nokia, kind of in the run up ahead of Quad 2 environment. And that was, to me, cause it performed relatively well in the last, prior to, 2020, the start of 2022. And I know you were kind of interested or sort of had, because it was sort of changing its business model a little bit in terms of Nokia itself, but we don't need to get into the nitty gritty there. But you're spot on in terms of, you can have the right thesis, the right concept, right? Of like the cell phone is going to change the way that we operate, do business, just interact with each other. And yet, if you had bought BlackBerry, you would have significantly underperformed the entire tech industry, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I like was the analyst at Putnam on Nokia during, kind of like that critical period, 2009, 10, 11. And I was visiting Helsinki, if not once a quarter, then once every other quarter, and sitting with the management team, and very often the CFO, who'd be like, we're not seeing it this month, we're doing great. And you have to see our new models like selling really well and all this kind of stuff. And then like they'd get to the end of the quarter and it would be like, just the quarter had sort of gently rolled over. And so guidance was going to be like a rolling over every time. It was like, every single quarter, the same thing. And then that CFO ended up joining an airline travel company, Sabre, that we had a short on very early on in my Hedgeye career. And he joined, and like after a year was talking as if he had spent his entire life in the airline industry. And you've never seen that, or we've done, like things like that in the last 20 years that hasn't happened, and things like, I'm like, how would you know? I'm like, you don't know.
Right, exactly.
And by the way, that happens. It that's kind of stuff like, those are like yellow or red flags when those things happen. Right. Like, like non-introspective, non-thoughtful, like dismissed, like when managing teams aren't even, Palantir, by the way, like not that far away from that when at the IPO, and even continuing when the founder and the COO like to, you know, debase the rest of the software industry is saying, you know, they say like the rest of the industry can't even do this. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, how would you guys know? You've never worked at any other company in the tech industry other than Palantir. And Palantir is a very insular company that knows itself and pretty much knows nothing else. And the tropes that they evoke are like at least 8 years old, right? Like it's like those things that they're saying, like, you know, are true from like 8 years ago. So it's just like red flags of like, you know, you guys are going and putting down the rest of the software industry, and you're just even using the wrong insults. You're like, your insults are 8 years old. Like, they don't exist anymore. Those problems have been solved. The tech industry has evolved.
Has evolved, exactly.
Now
exactly.
Those will be problems again, but like those haven't been problems for a long time.
Yeah.
So it's like a red flag. Like, oh, we got to go put down our competitors, and they don't know any. The rest of the industry doesn't know anything. And, you know, you don't have a basis for saying that. You know, if this was like a CEO who'd worked at, you know, six different software companies and been in the industry for 30 years, and he's done it all and been a CEO in all these places, and like specifically joined Palantir because they can do something no one else can. Look, that was the Snowflake CEO, right? Like, he joined Snowflake after ServiceNow and after this one and that one. And he had done like a lot of them. And he was like, this is unique. And he was right at the time that he joined. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's different.
I love, Jenner, if you go to slides 19 and 20, you track some really interesting commentary. And again, just like if you've watched these sector head spotlights at Gen Nation, there's a key theme here across all research or all sector heads, and it's the data, right? And I believe you're taking this from the 10K, the transcripts and or 10Ks, 10Qs. But you know, if you don't mind maybe expanding, because this, you know, this goes specifically into, you know, exactly what you're talking about, Ami, in terms of, you know, tracking what CEOs, CFOs, what the C-suite is trying to communicate either via their documents, either through the transcripts on the quarterly calls or in the actual reports themselves. And I think it's very fascinating. So I'd love to hear kind of how you, one, you know, how, not necessarily how you track it, but just sort of what influences these numbers, and then how your read on kind of the data that comes out of them.
So Gartner, going back to Gartner, has this thing called hype cycles. I find it to be a really interesting tool, but it was always like where the hype cycle was on the chart was always seemed a little bit too subjective. So we decided to try to quantify hype cycles, and we do that by capturing the mention of the hype cycle word or term in public documents. Mentions of it in public documents that go across press releases and filings and transcripts, public company transcripts and things like that. And just basically mentions out there in the world. And so we're able to create slides like that. And actually the first one we did was for an individual company. I think it was one of the first ones we did was the RPA one that we have in there. I don't know if you want to go there and take a look, but it was one of the, we were studying UiPath. It's not this slide. It's a different slide. Do you have the slide number? It's in the individual company stuff.
Oh, got it. I'll find it. I'll come back to it. I'll come back to it, Ami.
Okay. Well, actually, I just want to go to that slide just because
Okay. It was UiPath, right? Slide 15. Yeah. Slide 15, I think it is.
Let's see it.
Is that the right one?
Nope. It's the one. I think it's the one before that.
Oh, sorry. So 14 then. Yeah, RPA. Sorry. Yep. Apologies.
Okay, so this was... We've shown this chart and at this point, like those left-hand side, the black bar is like totally destroyed and rolled over. Okay. But this was at the IPO of a company called UiPath. It's like a big $40 billion, blah, blah, blah. Big, big deal. Very, very well loved. Even by people who are typically my clients who are skeptics, like at the time were really excited about this. It was growing like 80% year over year at scale, like over 600 million ARR, like growing really, really fast. And we had, and so, and like, by the way, and the founder, like really smart founder, really compelling, like thoughtful, like when you listen to him, you want to be involved. You want to be part of it. And at the time, so the core of what UiPath does is RPA, robotic process automation, which is a misnomer of a term, but it's like, you know, it's like as if you were, if you have like a manual set of work that you need to do, you need to like log into one system, then grab that data and export it into maybe an Excel into another system, and then, you know, link it up with another system and then log it somewhere else. Like, and you have to do that every morning or whatever it is to start your day. And that's like a quick, like half an hour thing that you can create an RPA for, robotic process automation, basically a screen. It records your screen as you go through from thing to thing and log in from thing to thing. And then you create that as your RPA, and it hits, you know, you can have that scheduled every day at 6:01 a.m. to run, and it runs for you. So you don't have, you can eliminate that 30 minutes of work, right? So that's very powerful potential little accelerator for an automator. It continues to be for many people. But it was an old technology, and it had come out of left field and like just like a clap of thunder, just went like nuts from like 2017 on. And the so at the company, so at UiPath. And we were like, how does this like hype cycle look? Are we like early in this, or is this like, are we late, right? Because we had started to talk to people where we had started to already get the sense that there was something was amiss, right? Like it wasn't like all things looked good. And then we ran this hype cycle chart on RPA, and you could see the left-hand side looked fine, right? Like maybe it was going to work out. And the right-hand side, the year minus year growth, the growth of dimensions, the growth of growth, looked like it was rolling over already, like meaning like it was a tiredness to this hype cycle. And that's what happens a lot of times at IPOs, by the way, is that like, you know, we're being sold something that already did well, not something that will do well. So that's kind of like one of those things that we are cautious of. So that's the background to these hype cycles. The ones you were showing was, you know, mentions of, you know, this was just sort of a look that we did in the fourth quarter. We don't always do the same screen, but like looking at growth and profits as part of like how people are thinking about things.
I like to, again, it's a little just a bit more macro, right? It was FX and macro and recession, right? Like that, and you found that in terms of, I know Microsoft back, I think it was Q2, you know, they had a, you know, they had an increased conversation or certainly dialogue around, their FX, you know, headwind that they were facing. I believe it was Q2, might've been Q3, but I thought it was just quite interesting in regards to what, just kind of like the data that you were tracking there.
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Hope you're enjoying our podcast. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street.
Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe.
Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Yeah, I mean, we try to see, like, is there like a bubble in people talking about FX, or is there like a bubble and people are just going crazy? This, you know, people talking about profits instead of growth. And like, is there some kind of big inversion, or does it just feel that way? Right. So you want to like back test against the data to see, like, is there some kind of like bubble forming in one of these areas that we should be worried about? And, you know, sometimes there isn't, like, you know, just it's good to test the data.
Yes, 100%. And so we got about 5 or 10 minutes here left, Ami. There is a phenomenal slide. Again, it tracks on the macro, you know, ties in kind of the macro thing as well in terms of .com bubble. But I know you often, you know, you're a bit more, you know, individual stocks versus kind of the thematic view. So I will defer to your judgment, to be perfectly frank, in regards to which direction you'd like to go next, because you've delivered a bunch of great slides. And so we could kind of go a couple different ways. Obviously, the layoffs that are happening in the tech world is certainly something that's hitting the news headlines quite frequently. With Meta most recently, cutting more jobs. But I'll defer to my teammate and sector head to see which direction we want to go here.
I think that there's a lot of different ways that people like to invest in this sector. I typically, and today, for example, we're having a very strong period where GARP style growth at a reasonable price. So kind of like a good enough growth and good enough valuation, sort of like a cross section of those two things, is doing well. And that may have legs for a little while because we're coming off of like a very heavy growth excess growth investing period. But I typically find that when I'm thinking about a company and its growth rate, if like one of the things that is that I like to think about a lot and try to understand is about like how deep and far this growth rate can go. Like how open-ended is the opportunity? And so this is one where like I often find myself, or Yosef and I, our team, we often find ourselves disagreeing with what's commonly available out there, because a lot of times we'll be looking at talking about some company that's putting up great numbers right now and strong growth. And investors like call us to shame us and email us hate mail and stuff like that because we're maybe short. Because if we think the growth is being driven by a price increase, or specifically the company taking price and narrowing their addressable opportunity, closing their road to future products, and if they do not have a good innovation roadmap for driving those future products into the market, and that's often why a company will get to that point where they're like, "Shit, we're our core product is adopted." We've seen winnowing adoption on that core product. We don't have something else to fill in the next big thing. So let's take price because we've underpriced ourselves historically in order to kind of like get a foothold in this market. And now it's time to take price. Well, that's a later stage of growth. That means that now you've already got to start thinking you've got to use this pricing period to waterfall to profits and drive some M&A so that you have something else to sell in the coming years. Very different multiple setup, very different rate of sustaining growth, totally different setup and usually shortable if it appears to be, if people have accepted this as a growth company. Whereas sometimes we'll be looking at a company with a low growth rate, maybe relatively low growth rate, who people argue, oh, the free version is just as good. But we see that actually the product itself is just emerging out of the free version, and you waterfall that forward a couple of years, and there's going to be a stark contrast. And not just that, but the company has product after product after product, or the market they're addressing is very large, or they are the monolithic shareholder of that market, and they dominated, and the entire world is shifting into this way. There's different ways of thinking about these kinds of things, but we like for longs, we're looking at something that can sustain growth for a long period of time rather than the eye candy of what's happening today, the sugar high of the current P&L, which is sometimes kind of like, as I mentioned before about the UiPath IPO, sometimes the sugar high, the P&L you're seeing today represents like adoption from 2 years ago to product to monetization. And if there isn't that ongoing wave to populate next year and the year after, whether it's next year or the year after, you're going to hit a wall on growth with that company. And if people aren't ready for that, you're in trouble with that stock. And vice versa is true as well, is that's kind of like one of the ways that we like to think about things is where are the blue sky, open-ended growth opportunities, companies that could grow for a very, very long time. And those are the things we get excited about and get long. And that has to do a lot with the focus on innovation and iteration and pricing focus and product and market fit and things like that, and constantly working to expand that opportunity. We don't always get it right, but that's kind of like in a general view. And one of the reasons, you know, it comes back to that, you know, the Palm versus BlackBerry or either one. The example I like to give more often is, you know, IBM versus Apple. One company is mailing it in and faking it along, and one company has innovated at least over the last decade and continues to innovate and continues to drive ecosystem growth. And one company is, you know, borrowing money, buying back stock, cutting this division, adding that division, you know, making M&A. Like it's just, you know, and losing in their core businesses. So.
Yeah, I thought your commentary a couple of weeks ago on Zoom in particular, just along those lines, where I believe the CEO, and again, please jump in if I'm misquoting you, but I believe, you know, on the call or in a transcript, on the earnings release, they were talking about how their innovation path is they have no problems basically, you know, building new products and creating new products from a Zoom standpoint, but it's the adoption from the end user and the client. that they're seeing is not quite as robust as one would, I guess, hope, or they were anticipating, which I thought was quite interesting, but really ties exactly into what you're speaking about, right? In terms of, okay, you know, the innovations there and the growth, and obviously Zoom, you know, was a huge beneficiary from the pandemic era and that kind of thing. And, but they, you know, the competition with Teams and et cetera, is obviously, I mean, you know, as in terms of the big behemoth. And I believe even on the call a couple weeks ago, you mentioned that you were like, you know, they'll, you know, folks from a Microsoft standpoint, they'll just throw Teams in their general enterprise package, because they don't really care, right? Microsoft doesn't care, but you know, Zoom's trying to differentiate themselves from a, excuse me, from a, I guess, product innovation standpoint a little bit as well. But
I would say is self-inflicted. They had a moment in time where they were they dominated all of our days and all of our lives, our work lives in many ways. Even some of our non-work lives were happening over Zoom, and they had an opportunity to scale out of that and functionality and really take over our productive lives with calendar and with there's so many different ways I can't even so many different collaboration methods and innovation methods that they could have used that would not have actually even cost them so much in terms of time and product to market and things like that. And instead they were counting coins and hiring people and basking in the money. And I think that there were two paths there. One was like really real innovation and roll out every single product that they can to take advantage of that moment in the sun that they had. And they didn't do that. And then the other opportunity is like hire as little as possible, allow this massive cash flow to come in and buy back, you know, as much of the stock as you can, drive a lot of cash flow, maybe make some acquisitions, you know, like that kind of thing. And they perfectly did neither of those end poles. They straddled the middle of that and under executed on either side of it. And so now they kind of have to figure out a road forward.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. I mean, we can talk about that for days, but, no, I think I guess where I leave it, cause this has been a phenomenal conversation. And so, I'll say two things here. One is, I was able to catch all of your podcasts, but it took me a day or two, delayed. So, but I did catch the one you had with Ed Hufnagel on this past Saturday. What a phenomenal conversation. I was able to catch up with that on Tuesday. So for those listening in, I'd highly recommend, go back and listen to all the Unscripted Equity, Equity Curiosity, podcasts, but in particular, this one on AI, because, in kind of the data war that's on the horizon. So rather than rehashing that, that subject matter on me, which I think is quite fascinating, obviously very topical, we will just point them to that podcast. Cause I think, again, it was a phenomenal conversation and I certainly learned a lot, from it. And then, secondly, I would say, you know, perhaps we could leave, you know, if you've got a general kind of thing that you're really keenly watching or trying to be aware of, doesn't necessarily have to be company specific or anything like that, or can be, but something that's kind of that's on very, very keen on your kind of horizon or view for the end of Q1 here going into the rest of 2023.
Yeah, I mean, I think the group is still benefiting from easier comps. I think the group is benefiting from all the OPEX tightness. I'm talking about enterprise software, yep. Benefiting from all the OPEX tightness and cutting that was instituted in 2022. And that sort of just started to roll into estimates. And we're going to get a benefit from currency, the opposite of the headwind. The headwind happened last year and starting in 2Q. So starting in 2Q, you're going to get tailwinds to the bottom, to the top line and bottom line, and to the free cash flow from that area. And you know, so I think you still have fundamental drivers for short-term estimate positive direction for the software industry. The problem is that this industry, because you're coming from a very, very, it was very expensive. It got very cheap. But on a fast rebound, these 100% pops we're getting in some of these stocks, you get expensive again pretty quickly. So I think that's you're looking into the later part of this year. You need strength and support out of backlog growth. And so far, you're getting better than feared backlog growth, but that's not the same thing as good backlog growth. So it's something that I'm looking at for the sector. And then from an individual stock perspective, like, you know, we all just got off this crazy roller coaster. People are nauseated and dizzied and whatever. And it's time to really sort through the stuff that's out there and find the gems and kind of knuckle down and, you know, own the gems and avoid the lose, short the losers. And it's one of those great opportunities that come in the sectors after like a big cyclical volatility period. And there probably will be more cyclical volatility in the short term, the next 6 months, but we're getting through it. And so there's opportunities to be to look for real assets in this. So that's kind of some of the things that I'm looking at.
Amazing. No, awesome. Ami, I appreciate your time. It's been a fantastic conversation. So thank you very much. And for those at home listening in, if you're interested in learning more about Ami's technology sector pro product, you can visit our HedgeEye products page or email in at support@hedgeye.com. We would be happy to help. And Ami just scratched the surface in terms of the not only the companies that he covers, but also the subject matter that he does as well. So again, Ami, really appreciate your time today and look forward to doing this again soon.
Don't forget to check out HedgeEye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @HedgeEye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by HedgeEye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. HedgeEye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of HedgeEye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the content. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by HedgeEye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.